And I've been given the unexpected privilege of introducing our next speaker. And it really is an honor because, I will explain. Most of you know our next speaker, our General Secretary of United Methodist Communications, the Reverend Larry Holland. We all know him, of course, as a former Communicator of the Year, a multi-gifted communicator who moves easily from video to radio to the written word and into emerging technology. But more than that, he is a person of vision who has elevated the work of everyone in this room. And you may not realize this, but Larry has almost single-handedly brought to the fore the understanding of communications as ministry. And he has been an advocate for the communicators in this room, for the importance of communications in the life of the church, in the highest circles of the church, as well as to probably any audience that he appears in front of. He's been an ardent advocate for the power of communications to transform lives. And in the process of doing that, he has also affirmed the importance that every annual conference communicator has in her or his ministry setting. Communications is a ministry. It is a ministry that has strategic value and is essential to the life of the United Methodist Church, especially in this digital age. And the last thing I will say about my boss is that he is a humble person, so I won't embarrass him by saying anything further. But please, here in this year of transition for United Methodist Communications and for Larry, please let's give him a very warm welcome today.
Thank you, Tim. That was a very, very nice introduction. I noticed that you had trouble getting started. You stumbled a little bit, but you did a good job. Good afternoon. I started to say good morning. Good afternoon. I hope you've had a good start to UMAC and that things are going well. It sounds like the fact that you had a delayed lunch was a pretty good indication of some good times happening. I was asked to talk a bit about some futuring, and so I'm going to do that. I'm not going to make a production out of it, but just do some free-form sort of thought with you all. And I thought about this. Why would anyone ask me to look at the future? The thought occurred to me, if the Mayans were any good at predicting the future, then there would still be Mayans. So whatever I say always has to be seen in the light of the temporary nature of predicting the future. But I was asked to talk about three things. One is the future of journalism. One is the future of religion in a digital culture. And the third, a look at culture itself and how it's being affected, and the future of culture is being affected by communication today, particularly digital media. So I wanted to just do some free-form sort of thinking with you about that. The first is with regard to journalism. It seems to me that we are at a cross point or a transition point with regard to traditional journalism and the multiple ways that journalism is being practiced today. The old style of journalism, which was based upon a kind of reporting of conflict with polar opposites being used as the reference points for storytelling, which then converge into conflict, which is used to engage readers or viewers, is being pretty much rejected today. If you look at the readership statistics of the New York Times, if you look at the viewership of news stations that practice that form of journalism, they are all hemorrhaging eyeballs. And a part of that, I think, is that we are rejecting that style of journalism. A part of it, of course, is that there are so many options for getting our information now that no one can hold that mass the way journalism has in the past. Information is now available to us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's waiting out there for us. We don't have to have it presented to us. It's waiting for us. And so we can go to it. With every new Google algorithm, it becomes easier to go to it. And this means that the older centralized forms of traditional journalism are having to change. What I think is happening, and what I think we as communicators in the church can do with the practice of journalism that is different and that would be more helpful, at least to those of our readers and viewers and those who use our information, is a different kind of journalism. And that is a solutions-based journalism in which we report on those things that are not causing the conflict, but those solutions to different challenges, problems, and conflicts that are being proposed by the church, by people of faith, and by people of goodwill, so that we offer not problems, but attempts at solutions. Where are the solutions being attempted? What is the social context that gives rise to these different solutions? What is working and what doesn't work? If people are turning off of traditional conflict-based journalism, there is a place for solutions-based writing. And we, as people of faith, who are seeking a world that is reconciled, a world that is more peaceful, a world that is built around community, are in a perfect position to offer a new style of journalism. The second thing I would say about that is that our role as communicators is becoming more complex and more sophisticated, because it involves supporting the needs of the church for communications, but I believe it also now involves the supporting the needs of people individually for information, particularly information about how to utilize media, how to work one's way through the information-rich society that we have to find that media, that information that is trustworthy, that is accurate, that is reliable, and that can be used effectively through educational content, through training, through self-development. And so the challenge that we face, in addition to practicing a new form of journalism, is going direct to the user. That's different. You and I, as communicators in the church, have always been, first of all, expressions or giving expression to the institution of the church. This new age of digital media means that the intermediaries are no longer as powerful or as important, because the information exists all around us. And so our challenge is to go direct to users, in some cases, with information, and in that process, become enablers of individuals, and not only enablers of the institutional church and the perceptions that people have about that. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm speaking against the institutional church. It means I'm saying that the role that we play is a more complex and more sophisticated role today as communicators than the role that we have played in the past. Now, the fact of the matter is many of the current generation of leaders in our church have a different view of media than this. and they see communication as a tool for persuasion and for support, and not as a matter of lifestyle in which we form attitudes, values, and behaviors. And so we will continue to face some challenges, I think, as Christian communicators, as church communicators, in fulfilling this complex role. But we have to find new ways to express it and take on new responsibilities. In a digital world, you as communicators are at the forefront of the challenges that are presented to us to understand new media, how to use its content, and what practices are best in using this new media. We are interpreters of this complex mix, as well as creators of content that leads people to understand the teachings of Christian faith. The last thing I'll say about this is that I would define this as helping people become fluent in new media, to give them a fluency about how to use this media that is, at the present time, still in the process of being created. Let me move to religion. Anyone who tries to talk about the future of religion today is not in his or her right mind, but here I am. There are two narratives, to simplify, I think there are two narratives at work. One is a corporate narrative of individualism that says that fulfillment comes by consuming goods and services. And believe it or not, that's a religious narrative. It's a false narrative that promises more than it can deliver, but it serves an economic model, and it serves it well because it requires that we continually spend and consume in the search for a more fulfilling life. Look at what we're offered when we're offered a cell phone contract. We're offered connection, and as if the tool itself gives us that kind of connection, but it comes with a 2-year contract, a $200 tool, and other commitments that lock us in, and it's a transaction. But the corporate narrative is so pervasive today, and it is a narrative of individualism, that it goes almost unnoted, and it is one that influences our lives and our children's lives, and is all-encompassing. The second narrative that is more frequently being offered is a religious narrative of personal piety and religious rites. This narrative privileges individual relationship to God and individual rites over self-sacrifice in service to others and a community of faithfulness that serves God and others. One of the challenges that we will face in the mainline denominations going forward is to overcome the religious narrative of personal piety and of religious rites that the evangelical right-wing political entrepreneurs have established as being the narrative of this day in the United States. The corporate cultural narrative is so pervasive that it is taking over the culture to the point where people now identify with corporate brands by wearing particular logos as status symbols. My argument with that is that when we are willing to give our identity over to a corporation, we are submitting to this narrative in profound ways that affect us by allowing ourselves to be defined by outward symbols that cannot contain the fullness of our sacred personhood, which Christians believe is bestowed to us by God. The religious narrative that I'm speaking about does not offer us the more humanizing values that the biblical teachings that I think we as a mainline Christian denomination hold. And that is that God's intent for all people is for us to flourish, and this means to live in peace with one another, to care for the vulnerable and the downtrodden, and to live our relationship with God by being in communion or in community with each other. And an individual narrative of personal piety and religious rites cannot accommodate that call to community and self-sacrifice and giving of oneself. One part of the challenge of faith in the 21st century is to resist the thought that meaning can be found through transactions and replace it with the more biblical teaching that we find meaning through the experience of being in relationship with a loving God. Genevieve Bell, an anthropologist who's worked at Intel for the past 16 years, says technology is contributing to these two narratives. The last thing, she says, after time and space that is changing is social relationships. How do we relate to each other? What do we think about social ideas like privacy, security, and risk? There are changing ideas about love, fear, passion. There are changing ideas about time, space, and social relationships, and all of this carries anxiety. We are reinventing a lot of ideas around security, privacy, safety, love, marriage, kids, God, violence, the nation state, power, justice, money. Everything is up for grabs, she says. How does this play out then in our daily lives? Let's talk about it in very practical ways. I hope you've seen the article by the Gen X mother that appeared in the New York Times about a week ago, in which she makes the case that Gen X parents face challenges because of new media unlike any that parents before have ever experienced. She says she drives her children to school every morning by the same route, going by a river because the river is beautiful. Sometimes in the early morning, the light looks differently from day to day. Sometimes there's mist on the river. Sometimes the leaves create different kinds of patterns of light and shadow. Sometimes the trees are a different color. She looks in the rearview mirror at the four children, two neighborhood children and her own, who are in the car that she's ferrying to school. And as she's contemplating the beauty of the river as they go around the road that follows the river, she sees that they're on their screens. And she tries to get them to look up. And they're more involved with the screens and engaged with the screens than they are with the beauty of nature outside. And the point she makes is that their experience of the world is a different experience than the world that she is trying to give to them. And this concerns her because that experience of childhood that they are having is not the experience of the beauty of nature nor of the river, but of the game that they are playing on the way to school, and that it blocks out a whole part of the world that she wants them to know about. Language shapes us, and technology shapes us. We conform to technology, and to a degree, we conform technology to us. But the important reality is that technology changes us. The I-everything generation, that is, the children of Gen Xers, are the first generation to be born into everything connected. You and I more than you, have seen media introduced into my lifetime. The I-everything generation is born into a media environment in which everything is connected, and it is not new to them. It is the world that they inhabit. How will this change their understanding of the natural world? How will they view the world differently from those of us who have grown up in a world in which change came through a process of evolution, however fast, from print media to broadcast to an explosion of digital media, first on desktops, and then on laptops, and then mobile phones, and then tablets, and now handheld devices for gaming, and phablets, and smartphones, and biometric wristbands, and biometric chips implanted in the pets that we own, and someday, under our own skin. I believe we can help people through these two narratives and assist in offering a third narrative, which is a teaching of the Christian faith that we are put here for a purpose, we are called to be in relationship with God and with others, and to have this relationship, we are called to serve and not merely to consume, and to engage the world and not merely view the world through a screen. The biblical call is a call to sacrifice, to seek justice, to offer compassion, and to show mercy. And today, in a digital culture, this is countercultural. It is also communal. It is expressed through relationships, not through the buying and selling of things. It has no monetary value. It operates on a different level than that which money can buy. The third is culture. Christian Piatt is a postmodern writer, post-Christian author. He's written What's Left, Post-Christian What's Left, Can We Fix It and Do We Care? He says, and I quote, "The internet, along with the way it changes the way we interrelate, communicate, seek, and consume information, is certainly doing its part to contribute to the decline of religious institutions. And it's not just the church that is feeling the pinch. Any hierarchic system in which the institution traditionally has played the role of gatekeeper, or mediator, is finding its authority challenged. It is no longer the mainline denominations that are losing members and participation. Now, megachurches are seeing a churning of membership, and evangelical faith groups are also seeing decline. The tired old claim that the reason the mainline churches are in decline is because of mainline liberals who are killing the denominations is betrayed by the decline of all kinds of religious institutions, including conservative religion. Not civil religion, but membership organizations like congregational denominations are in decline. Something more widespread than theological and ideological differences is happening. Besides creating anxiety, technology rearranges power and authority. With the decline of gatekeepers and authority figures comes a decline in privilege and power. This creates in those who have enjoyed privilege and power a reaction to hold on and recover what is slipping away, but it also causes a loss of direction about what to do next and confusion about what role can be played by the leader. We as a denomination face real tensions today. Those tensions get played out in terms of authority and power. They get symbolized in the issues that we have around human sexuality. But underneath those issues are deeper issues, and those are issues about power and authority. Who has the authority to interpret the Bible? And by what power do they offer that interpretation? And so many more of these kinds of conflicts, I think, are in our future. And our challenge as communicators is to point to those underlying issues and try to help people understand and ourselves understand those issues, because the conflicts that are on the surface are underneath much more deeply embedded in the changes that are happening in the culture today. And those changes are made possible because the information is out there available to everyone, and everyone can be an authority and can have an opinion and can retreat to the information that is suitable for the individual. So the challenge of building relevant faith community in the digital environment is significant, and one that I think we will all be struggling with for some time to come. Now, let me close this with several really quick points. The process of the digitizing of culture and society is not going to retreat anytime very soon. In fact, it's going to ramp up, and places that have not experienced digital culture as we are experiencing it and as it is experienced in the more developed countries of Asia are going to see the same dynamics introduced in their cultures and in their societies. In the Philippines, the average age is 23. The Philippines is the texting capital of the world. Did you know that? More text messages are being sent from the Philippines than from any other place on this earth. The reason is Filipinos are a very hospitable, very conversational, very open society. And what they have done is adapted to text messaging as a way to extend that traditional conversational culture and that traditional hospitality. Manila is the number one user of the United Methodist Facebook page. We have more viewers from Manila as a city in block than we have from any other part of the world. In Africa, a rising middle class is developing in many countries, and a new generation of African entrepreneurs is changing the continent. Hear this figure. The average age of the African population is 18, and 40% of Africans are under the age of 14. That's 416 million people. Think of that as a market for mobile technology. The world now has 5 billion mobile phones, one for every person over the age of 15. Africa has 1 billion people and 750 million phones. Mobile phone use is growing so fast there that in a few years there will be more phones than there are people. In some countries in Africa, this is already the case. South Africa has 47 million people and 52 million mobile phones. A group called Balancing Act did a thorough market study in Africa in 2013 and found that internet use is up to such a point that it is now a close third in use to radio and television. Feature phones are owned by a majority of the people in Africa, and they want to upgrade to smartphones, and they will do so when the price is right. China is manufacturing a smartphone that is supposed to market between $70 and $80. The Mozilla Foundation is introducing a smartphone in India that will sell for $20. Balancing Act says when smartphones sell for $50 or less, Africans will buy. What is happening then is that the world is becoming digitized and connected electronically. At United Methodist Communications, we have seen our ICT 4D initiative explode. ICT 4D stands for Information Communication Technology for Development. It started with one person, Neely Hicks, on a halftime basis 4 or 5 years ago, and a budget that was embarrassing. I mean, embarrassingly small, like $10,000. Today, we have three staff people who are working full-time, an engineer, a project coordinator, and Neely Hicks, who does a remarkable job of networking. You have seen that we've put an animation on Ebola into the hands of two television distributors in Africa that will reach upwards of 40 million households. It has been accepted by the World Health Organization, by the U.S. State Department, by other UN organizations, by ministries of health, and by hundreds, if not thousands, of community health workers in different definitions, high definition for TV, low definition for laptops. And Neely and the team are having conversations with USAID, with the U.S. State Department, with the World Health Organization, with the World Bank, with a handful of UN organizations, in addition to all of the central conferences that are concerned with this current epidemic. We provided emergency telecommunications after the typhoon in the Philippines a year ago, and it was the church who responded quickly to the need for reestablishing telecommunications in Tacloban, and today that communication system is still connecting aid agencies working in the Tacloban region. We have a major initiative that we are starting at UMCOM to provide parents of children between the ages of 3 and 11 with information about how to manage media use and provide creative content for children for values education. To our knowledge, no group is doing this on behalf of mainline communions, and it's my belief that the church must be involved in this work because this is where we are living our lives, it is where our lives are being informed by values, and it is how we are living out our daily aspirations in a communications environment with digital media. I've said to our board and I've said to our staff, we as a church cannot leave it to Disney and other corporations to provide values-oriented content to our children. We have to be engaged in that arena. We're inviting partners to help us in this initiative. We think it will start with a web page, a website for parents and children. We will partner with Common Sense Media out of San Francisco. We will create other kinds of models for the Philippines and for Africa, not the same as the United States. And we are interested in creative partners. If you're interested and you want to be a partner, we would welcome conversation with you. And if you have creative content producers who can help us develop values-oriented content, we would like to talk with them as well. Really some major points now. I'm kind of, as I said, I'm doing free-form thinking here, and I'm going to go through several things really quickly, and I'll stop, and maybe we'll have time for questions, and maybe I've already overrun my time. We've asked the FCC to activate FM chips in smartphones. My reason for asking them to do that is that I think that smartphones ought to be able to receive FM signals during emergencies. The chips are already in the smartphones. The only reason they're not activated, according to the radio people that I talk to, is that the data sellers don't want to activate a chip that would provide you with a free radio signal if they can sell you data time, which you will then use by putting an application on to receive music or radio through a paid subscription. The chips are there and simply need to be activated. In Tacloban, when the typhoon came, before the internet could be connected and the cell towers could be raised and the Wi-Fi towers could be erected, the only means of communication for several days was radio. That's true in the United States as well. It would be much easier for us to have an FM transmitter in our smartphone with no data charges, with over-the-air signals, to be able to receive emergency communication, and that's available to us, but we need to penetrate whoever will regulate that process. So we've asked the FCC to do that. Some say the FCC doesn't have the ability to do that, and that's an interesting challenge in itself because that's another issue. When you have a smartphone with the capability of acting like a radio, then you've got a device that crosses boundaries. It may be that it's beyond the authority of anyone to regulate, and it's the typical example of what happens in this digital age. A quick point. Millennials and their giving patterns have grown up with technology. Millennials are choosing to give directly. They do not give to an organization to allow the organization to do its work on their behalf. They want to give directly to interact with that project that they or that cause that they want to give to. They want to report back on it to know how effective it is, and they want to know what the outcome is. That challenges us, friends, when we have given ourselves over to a giving system that is based primarily on an offering plate or primarily on commitment to an organization which will then carry out mission on our behalf and in our name. The new giving platforms that must be developed must be platforms that serve a digitally aware constituency who want to give in direct ways, who want to interact with that object or that destination point, and who want feedback from that to know if that giving made a difference. We at UMCOM developed the strategy for Giving Tuesday, which raised $6.5 million last year. That mobile platform needs to be more than it is today. It needs to be a platform that is available for the whole mission of the United Methodist Church, for education, for communication, for leadership development. It needs to be expanded so that we begin to test what is the next iteration of a giving system in the United Methodist Church. Failing this is courting obsolescence. If we are not able to change those institutional behaviors that were developed in the 1950s to adapt to a new digital reality, we court obsolescence. The jury is still out on whether we will be able to make that adaptation or not, but I hope we do. Let me give you two or three examples, and then I'm going to stop. One sentence or as short as I can make them. Did you know that it's now possible for every refugee and every displaced person who comes in contact with a non-governmental organization in a refugee camp to have a digital medical record? The government of Luxembourg has funded a $16 million electronic cloud medical database that it is making available free of charge to non-governmental organizations to track the health of emergency disaster victims, refugees, displaced persons who come in contact with the NGO and are in need of medical care. What this means fundamentally is that it is now possible, not just in theory, but were we to engage in it in a constructive way, for every person on earth to have a medical health record with a database that could track that person's health and health issues throughout life. The digitization of humanitarian aid will change the way the church does mission and is changing how humanitarian aid is being offered today. A card with an electronic chip is being used in refugee camps in the Middle East to serve displaced people from the war in Syria. The chip contains biometric information, family size, food portions that the family has received, the kinds of food the family has received. It also feeds into a database that allows the humanitarian organization to assess the needs of the family, analyze data for logistics, how to move food from one location to another in an efficient way, where it is possible to buy food that the family likes in the local market rather than having it shipped in from Europe or the United States, and to assess needs for the future, as well as manage supplies on hand. The digitization of humanitarian aid is proceeding apace, and older ways of providing humanitarian aid will have to change and will become obsolete if they don't change. Mobile money is now making it possible for our own Board of Pension and Health Benefits to make pension payments to retirees, not refugees, but to retirees in remote locations in Africa. Barbara Bergegreen told me recently on a trip to East Congo, one man walked over 20 miles to meet her in person to thank her for the check that he receives, which he gets on his mobile phone in remote East Congo as the compensation for his service as a clergy person in that annual conference. Mobile education is bringing the store of the world's knowledge to children who have in the past been limited to learn with no textbooks or with textbooks that are so out of date that they are almost useless. If the church is able and sees its way to provide e-readers to children for education in church schools as well as public schools, it will provide a new form of education at a higher level with greater access to useful information than the world has ever known before. All of these technologies are communications tools that you use and that are a part of your daily portfolio in the expression of work that you do as communicators in the United Methodist Church. All of these technologies disrupt and create new experience, new perspectives, and new categories of products and services. As communicators in the church, we are in the center of these sweeping changes. It is the best of times to be a communicator in the United Methodist Church. Our messages, that God's love is given to all, remains the same. The message does not change, but the way it is expressed and the means through which it is expressed has never been more open to innovation, to creative methods, and to the use of creative tools. I pray that we as communicators will be at the forefront of exploring how faith is passed on through these new media, and that we continue to provide the leadership and guidance that is essential for passing the faith on so that it is heard, engaged, and lived. Our mission can be nothing less. As I leave you as the General Secretary of United Methodist Communication, I wish for you that mission and that engagement, because you are in the position to be agents of transformation for the world, and nothing less. Thank you. Are we okay with time? Okay. Neil says we're okay with time for a few questions, if you have any, or feedback. What are my plans? I want to stay involved in some of the same kinds of things that I'm doing now, particularly in enabling communities to have communication access to information. To my great surprise, I've had a number of approaches from different organizations and groups to do that, and so I'll try to continue. I'm not really ready to retire, and I never thought I would live this long, and so I'm refusing to admit that I'm this old, so that I can keep doing some things that are more fun than sitting on the deck and watching the birds. Although I kind of like to do that too. Yes, Catherine. I think, thank you, I like that question a lot. I think that what we have got to do as communicators is to continue to point to the mission of the church as the guiding conversation that we need to be having. I think the unity of the church is what we have to be committed to. I think that it is our responsibility to be committed to the unity of the church. We also know that the issues that are causing dissension at the present time are not issues that the majority of the people of the church want to see as the defining issues. You know the poll that UMCOM did about what are the top issues. The top issue that people identified was the mission of the church to make disciples. Second was vital congregations and how to make vital congregations. And then there were five other issues before we got to the issue of human sexuality. I think it was seventh or eighth in the process. What is happening right now is that people who have strongly felt beliefs on the issue of human sexuality are framing the conversation for the whole church. And what we must do as communicators is seek to provide a larger conversation for those folks who are not framing it on the because of their deeply felt needs or feelings or perspectives, who are in the middle. We want to frame a conversation for folks in the middle about the mission of the church. What is the church about in the 21st century? What ought the church be doing about huge issues of poverty, of the need for education, for access to health care? What should the church be doing about how it invites people into the Christian faith today in a world in which, at least in the developed world, folks don't have the language of faith, don't know the words of faith, don't understand what we're talking about when we talk about religion? We've got to take back the conversation for those in the middle so that they can have those important conversations about the future of the church and how it goes forward. Now, the other thing I would say is I am a very strong believer, although I am not, you would not believe it, but I'm not the quintessential bureaucrat. And what I mean by that is I never saw myself being a bureaucrat in the general church. That's not something that comes natural to me. And I am not one. I did, ever since seminary, I've done underground newspapers that attacked the establishment and kicked at the shins of the institution, and I am not one who is comfortable being a spokesperson in an institutional way, simply for the institution. But here's the thing. The United Methodist Church, as a connectional system, has scope and scale to transform the world that few others have. Our connection is a strategic asset, in addition to being a wonderful theological, faith-based community. If we preserve this connectional system by keeping it unified, we preserve the ability to bring scope and scale to change the world for constructive and humanitarian purposes and for religious purposes that are amazing. When this church got involved in Imagine No Malaria, the very fact that the United Methodist Church was present in that movement gave the movement new energy. and a new sense of purpose and of hope. And that is because we are viewed as being an institution that has grassroots support that is important for scope and scale. In the United States, it means that we have 30,000 congregations for whom there is the possibility of doing education about this health issue. In Africa, where at the end of the road, you get off the bicycle or whatever the vehicle is you are, and you walk into the bush, and you come upon a community where there is a local United Methodist Church that perhaps even the health department of that government cannot reach. And that gives us a scope and scale at that end of the supply chain that is coveted by others. The unity of the church is important to us for theological reasons. It's important to us because it keeps us an integrated and inclusive community of people with different perspectives that we need, but it's also important as a strategic asset because it gives us that scope and scale that makes it possible for us to do what we say we want to do, be disciples of Jesus Christ who transform the world. I think that's a pretty important value for us to uphold. And as we approach General Conference, I think we need to remind ourselves and our people that that value is something that would be lost if we split over issues, important as they are, that would make us less than a whole people. And so I'm very supportive of the unity of the church and of the church as a transforming agent in the world that has scope and scale. Greg.
I'm either going to prove that I didn't catch your point, or I'm going to help you make a point or something here. So let me put three things together. You talked about in journalism, it's now the individual journalist. There are no intermediaries. And that you then talked about the same factor for interpretation of the Bible. That made me think back to the Gutenberg days of printing the Bible. People were worried because then they'd have it. We took away the priests as interpreters, and now we're seeming to do that again ourselves, and we see more lay preachers in our churches and all these things. So I guess I'm sort of looking for where that third piece is as we talk about as the institutional nature of our church, and is there a similar individualism, democratization, and that almost seems to speak against what you're just saying about the unity. And at some point you just wave at me, because if I've made enough points here that it makes you think of something you want to say, I'm trying to figure out where the connection is there and how do we keep that unity as everybody seems to be looking for their individual interpretation, because everybody gets to be right now because their interpretation can be right.
Yeah, I think that being Christian, but fundamental to being Christian means accepting that God has a claim on your life, and that claim calls us to be in relationship with God and with each other. And so we are called by the claims of God to be in community. We may not always agree with each other about specific issues, but we need to resist the call of the culture to claim individualism as foremost against the claim of God for us to be in relationship with each other. And that's why I think we preserve the church and the community of faith, because it is based upon the claim of God for us to be a people who do transforming work and who are transformed by being in community. My point about the individual journalists is not so much that that we are individual as journalists, but that as a style of journalism, we can practice solution-based journalism in which fundamentally people are coming together to find solutions to problems that exist and are building community and supporting community solutions. So I don't think, in my thinking, Greg, I may have not been as clear as I need to be, that I'm seeing a tension between the work that we do, the journalism that we practice, the need for unity of the church, and the fact that we go as representatives of the church, as communicators of the church, to people individually through media in order to attract them into the community. I don't think that we want to support a kind of individualism that says, "All you don't have to go to church. All you have to do is watch somebody on TV or subscribe to a podcast or listen to a radio show, and that's enough for your religious growth." I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we can be interpreters and guides to folks, but we need to attract them into the community of faith. Does that answer your question?
It continues the thought process.
Okay. Well, as I said, I didn't come here with an outline, really. These are ideas, and they're kind of scattershot. But I think that also that's the world we live in today. It's a nonlinear world, and I find myself doing this more and more, yeah, thinking it through as I go. Any other questions? Yes.
You discussed culture of communications. I'd like to hear your reflections on working as communicators within this culture that we're all dealing with, and I'm not talking about the church. I'm talking about a very contentious world in which we're living, in which the church is viewed askance, mm-hmm, in some quarters. And I would just be curious and about your view of how we go about working within the total overall culture that we're called upon to communicate within.
One of the things that I find interesting is that when I write about and talk about it is God's intent that all people flourish, that captures attention, and it surprises me. Honestly, I was in a meeting the other day where I said that, and it was a group of religious people, but they were not from a mainline tradition. They were from another tradition, and they hadn't thought of it that way. I think when we talk about a God of love, a God who is gracious in giving love, when we talk about a God who is therefore not judgmental, but stands with us in our suffering, and who is present with us in the challenges that we face, that we are then speaking to a different religious perspective that has not been heard in the culture. Because what has been heard is a more judgmental image of God, a God who brought Hurricane Katrina because this country was unfaithful, a God who is who has to be defended behind a bunker of piety and biblical blessed militarism, because if we don't defend God, who will? Well, the arrogance of that is God does not need our defense. We need God. And when we begin to reverse those categories, and talk about a God of love, a God of grace, talk about a life of service and sacrifice, talk about not individualism, but individual fulfillment through doing the will of God, accepting God's claim on your life, and working in community to make the world a better place, we've shifted the categories. And it seems to me it's as simple and as complicated as that. You present a whole different view of God, and it's a Wesleyan view. It's not a new view, and it's not unique but it's a view that's not been heard. And that's because the mainline churches lost their voice several years ago and stopped giving communication serious attention and stopped putting money toward doing communication. And we've got to call the church back to that. And we have an opportunity to do that now. Anyone who does not see that the crisis in West Africa is fundamentally a crisis of communication is just not seeing the picture. Communication in West Africa precedes everything else. And the failure of the WHO and of those governments to communicate accurate information and to have a good relationship with people so that the information they did transmit was accepted as being accurate and authentic contributed to what we're now going through. The role that you have as communicators today has never been more important. And I hope you accept that. I hope if you hear nothing else that I say, my last words are to you that your role as communicators is a fundamentally important role for the church today. And you have a responsibility to live into that role and to function with real care for the power that is in your capacity to help the church find new ways to express itself, new ways to give voice to its concerns, and new ways to address people who don't know the church. It's really an important role. Thank you.